The question was asked, how do we use archaeology with regard to deciding halacha, with regard to understanding halacha? And I would like to divide our discussion into a few segments. Let's begin first with an understanding that we do use science in halacha. We can begin with the letter from the Rambam's son about how the rabbis actually gleaned from the wisdom of the nations in their scientific writings, that when the rabbis wrote scientific things, it was greatly based on the understanding of the science of their times. So they used the science of their times, we use the science of our times. There's a response of the Chassam Sofer to that effect regarding the use of medicine. We say this very often, that we use our modern medicine and our modern doctors to understand when something is pikuach nefesh or not. Just one second, please. So that's the first point we have to know, that as a general approach, we do use the science of our times with many halachic applications. The next question is, how do we view archaeology? So the truth is that we have a bit of a problem, because although in other areas of science you can really see if a medicine works or doesn't work, when it comes to archaeology, you're taking certain findings and you're trying to reconstruct the picture. And to really decipher what the picture you're reconstructing is not as simple as it would seem. And if you actually analyze the findings of archaeologists, you can very often come to other conclusions. Let's take an example from our second topic tonight, which will be ancient halachic sources or ancient halachic texts. Let's imagine you're going through the Cairo Gniza and you come up with a sixth book to the Torah. Well, let's just take a wild example, right? So you come up with a Sefer Torah that has six books instead of five, and Moshe Rabbeinu suddenly has much more to say about life. So you could come out with this rare finding and say, you know, the archaeological dig shows that there was a sixth book to the Torah. Must be all our tradition is warped, and we all have to start adding this sixth book to our Torah. When in fact, there was a quack who wrote a sixth book. You know, he thought it was a cool thing to do, and that's why they buried it. And now you're gonna take this finding and build mountains off of it, when really it could be that's the reason it was buried. So there's a very big danger when you're looking at archaeology. It's not as accurate a science as other areas of science. So let's take the example that people like to quote. So they find a cave out near the sea where they would make a dye. And now people say, here, you have a proof that this is the dye of the Tcheles. I didn't see the logical buildup there. I have a proof that in this cave they created this dye. That's all I know. Maybe they made it for a king in Timbuktu. I don't know more than that. So I have to reconstruct. I find a letter. What does that letter tell me? That someone wrote something. Doesn't tell me more than that. I don't know who wrote. I don't know what his perception of life was. And I don't know what weight to give it. So if I find the Dead Sea Scrolls, do I know if those were Karaites? Do I even know if they were Jews who wrote that? Maybe they were Canaanites who wrote that. So when we deal with archaeology, we have to remember that we're not really dealing with an accurate science. We're dealing with a certain amount of science and a large amount of deciphering. And here, that's where we enter a realm which is really up to interpretation. And that's where it's very dangerous. People will say, you know, we found tefillin that were Rashi. So isn't that a proof that we should all wear tefillin like Rashi? No, because maybe one day you'll find tefillin like Rabbeinu Tam, which they recently have. Recently they found film like Rabbeinu Tam. So until they found that find, people were saying, it's ridiculous to wear Rabbeinu Tam tefillin. Look, all the archaeological finds so far are all like Rashi. There's a machlokas Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam, what the order of the parshiot within the tefillin are. So they said that's a solid proof Until they found another find in another dig, an ancient tefillin that were set up like Rabbeinu Tam. It happens to be in the Zohar, it says, from the days of Moshe Rabbeinu, they had tefillin like Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam. So it shouldn't surprise us too much. I don't learn Zohar, but Rav Margoliot quotes it in his book. Yes?
In the case we're discussing, it, I don't believe it's analogous to any of these, but Herzog, who was the proponent of trying to use extensive archaeological research, among other tools at his disposal, was trying to find the proper animal from which to produce the chelets, basically claimed that you have to use as much evidence as you can from all sources, and you have to rely on not just circumstantial or inconclusive finds, but actual concrete things to show to move a certain point. He wasn't trying to, let's say, invent a new book of the Bible or to say whether what kind of filament to wear, but rather he was just trying to show that indeed people were using the murex to dye wool for tzitzis, that color, here in ancient Israel. And
okay.
That's why it was sufficient.
And even that, if we take that one step further, if we want to be really analytical, the fact that people used the murex does not prove that the murex is tcheles. You had Amoratsim who were shechting fish. So you have a whole business of producing dye with the murex, which I'm not denying that the archaeological evidence supports that someone was using murex to dye wool blue. But we know that the kings, when they exiled Israel, the Navi says they left people here to develop the blue dye of tchelet. So, does that mean it's the identical tchelet we use for tzitzis? It means someone was developing it. That's all you know.
But he also proved that, and this is one that they discovered after his death, for certainty, that it turns out that which he recommended doing with murex becomes chemically identical, final product, to indigo.
Fine, but that's not archaeological. So then we go into the discussion of...
But Chazal said that if you do tchelis right, only God can tell the difference between wool dyed with indigo and wool dyed with tchelis. And this basically shows it. Yeah, indeed, it's true. If you show any sample of the two, once you have the final product, only God could tell the difference.
I don't want to go into that because that's not our discussion right now.
Okay.
So let's hold off, because if we're going to quote Chazal, then we should quote all of Chazal, and then we have some of Chazal that don't exactly fit into the murex. So let's wait. I'm saying that's not our discussion. Right now we're having a general discussion about archaeology and Torah. And I'm just saying that using archaeology to prove things in Torah is very complex because of the limitations of archaeology. Because archaeology involves a lot of guesswork. And you can't decide halacha based on guesswork. Yes?
Is there somebody specifically meant to be serving a trumpet?
I didn't hear you.
Is somebody specifically meant to be serving a trunk, or does it matter?
I think we usually take a vote. We take volunteers. Yeah.
There was a guy with a big spoon before.
I think you tell me.
But you would agree in halacha, like, with at least Maimonides' opinion, that if you define something.
If you were?
Define something conclusive. Maimonides would look through, for example, old books himself, and he said that he did this himself, and that he would like to do this some more, to look through ancient texts and try to find correct texts of things, or try to find more proof to something.
That's part two. That's exactly what I'm leaving for part two.
Oh.
As far as texts. I'm saying let's begin with a broader discussion. We'll get to texts in part two. So we have a Gemara. The Gemara tells us that one of the rabbis was shown the people who passed away in the desert. And one of the other rabbis said to him, "What'd you do?" He said, "I looked at them." He says, "Why didn't you look at their tzitzis? See if it's like Beis Hillel or Beis Shammai." So that Gemara seems to indicate that had he seen that it was like Beis Hillel or Beis Shammai, then we could have a conclusion. We'd be able to know. So that Gemara certainly seems to give us an indication that if we can prove what was, then that'll have impact on what is. We have to realize that there are limitations even to that, because in the days of the Second Temple, the rabbis knew exactly how they libated the wine in the days of the First Temple, and yet They gave halachic ruling disqualifying that and ruling that from that day onward they have to libate differently. So it's not as open as we think that if I can prove that something was done this way 2,000 years ago, that means that's the way I have to do it today. Not necessarily. You know, every halacha and its definition, in some areas, the rabbis knew full well the history and nonetheless decided that it has to be different from this day onward. So each halacha has its own realm, but there definitely is an area where we say, if I could verify what happened, then I would know. So one big area of discussion would be maybe with regards to kezias. If we want to know, did our measurements change? So why don't we check archaeologically? So the question is, would that really resolve the question? Yes, we have many digs that indicate that their mikvos were the size of the smaller size, what's commonly called Rav Chaim Noah, which basically says our olive is not much different than the days of the Talmud, our egg is not much different than their egg, and so when our sages say you have to eat the volume of an olive of matzah on the Seder night, that works. There were old rabbis who recounted that they'd sit down by their rabbi and eat at the Seder night. And one matzah somehow had enough kezaisim for quite a few students. You know, lo and behold, kezais was around the size of an olive, right? It seems like a far-fetched thing that a kezais would be like an olive. But at the end of the day, you check the mikvahs they're finding archaeologically, and they definitely do support that side. So again, we'd have to ask, but maybe we'll find more mikvahs that are the other side. They don't. That doesn't prove it necessarily. Yes.
Honestly, we find mikvahs everywhere that Jews live. Every single mikvah is of the smaller size. We're hoping that one day they'll find an exceptionally large mikvah that that'll just prove that everybody was using small mikvahs. The fact that you only found one big mikvah and you found thousands of small ones. Right?
What's the oldest mikvah we found so far?
I would call it the Mediterranean Sea. The oldest one is how do you know it's the oldest? It's an archaeologist has to tell you that one.
I'm asking. The Shitasam. The Erech? I don't know. I'm asking.
I'm trying to think now.
Okay. I don't know. I don't know. I'm asking. I don't know.
There's certain ones. There are ones on Masada. Those are easily before the common era when they were made.
Okay. Because it's interesting. If we go back a mere 600 years ago, we have letters from Tzfat to Europe where they're already discussing the discrepancy of the measurements. So I don't want to get bogged down with this specific discussion about measurements. There's a very interesting answer a professor here in Israel came up with. Maybe afterwards, while we're all eating chont and we're not on record, we can discuss that. But coming back to where we started, we do find areas where the Talmud says, let's see what happened. What? Is that the whole Masechet? Okay. I didn't understand that that's the idea of the Masechet. Let me ask you a question. Why is it different? What's the difference between what's said in that Masechet and what any Tana would quote not in that Masechet? I'm saying if Rabbi Akiva says this is the din, this is how a person becomes a mamzer, that doesn't make it into the Masechet. And yet when you have other quotes of other Tanaim, it does get into the Masechet. What's the difference? Did you learn? It's not. You read through the Masechet, not at all, starting from the first Mishnah. Shammai omer mikav lechala, Hillel omer mikavayim. Shammai omer melohin. No, that's the second parak, and the first three Mishnayot, Hamachlokot Bechamayim Betilel, and each time Chachamim Rim Lo Kedivrei Zeh Lo Kedivrei Zeh, and on the third or fourth Mishnah you have Atshebao Shnei Gardim Veidu. There you have the Idut. So the Chora, it doesn't seem that way, right? I'm saying that if you look through the Mishnah, I don't think so. I think it's a little different. The definition of Masechet Eduyot. We need to understand it. I'm saying it's a discussion in the Rishonim, but I don't think that's the definition. Yeah.
I was just gonna say, when you're talking about like this whole thing about the like being all of today, I mean there's like all different types of sizes of olives.
Oh, okay, so the Mishnah tells us it's Zayis Aguri. Over here it happens to be that if we go with the Chasam Sofer and the Chavos Yair, so there they clearly say that the olive can shift from generation to generation. So even if I'll prove archaeologically that their olives were a different size, that's fine, because what we're saying is that they had a different olive, right? And our olive changed. They had a different egg and our eggs changed. What? Aguri. Yes, that's what the Gemara says. I didn't hear. Yes. So no, Zayis Aguri is an olive that, first of all, it's a type, but it's quality, not its defining quality. It's a type, that's its definition. It has a quality that it can produce a lot of oil, that it maintains the oil within as it grows. Agur is a word in Mishle. Agur means to contain. Shlomo was called Agur. Maybe that's where Igor comes from. I'm joking. So Agur, that was one of King Solomon's name. And this olive is called Zayis Aguri. And the Talmud says that it has this quality that it retains a lot of oil, that you can really get a lot of oil out of it. But I don't know that we have any way of proving which is the Zayis Aguri. We have olives that produce a lot of oil, but which one it is, I don't know. That's another discussion, right? How do you decide? That's a machlokas tanoim. It's a machlokas tanoim. We generally say you take the average. Okay, but there are three types of average, right? Mean, mode, average. Yeah. Okay. That's also a machlokas tanoim. So let's wait. I just brought it as an example. I'm just saying that's an example where the Chasam Sofer and the Chavos Yair and the Igros Moshe, they all say that the olives can change with the generation, and you go with what you got. Yes?
I know that they say that, and the Chasam Sofer said that too, but where did they get that from? Because the Spartan people who lived, let's say, here forever, never said such thing, and they actually claim the opposite, that olives have always been olives, and the same trees that have been growing here since, you know, patriarchal times are the same trees that have been growing here now. It always seems to be people who live not anywhere near those olive trees who make that claim.
So let's take a step back. Before I prove what I'm saying, who are you quoting?
What?
Who is saying that?
Rav Chaim of the legend said that.
Said that what?
Said that the olive has always been the olive, and that's why the Spartans.
But he wasn't living here.
I know, but he said this in contrast to all the other people who were around him who were coming up with bigger...
But wait. Which Spartan? Who was there that says they have such a tradition, the olives didn't change? You know, you'd have to have had a measurement of an olive to actually say that.
No, they had olives. They don't even have to say this because they just say things. Olive is olive. Remember the first time you're in yeshiva and you hear about this, there's olives, then there's a halachic concept of olive. But that only exists among a certain side of the world.
If I have to contend with a claim, I have to understand where the claim is coming from. Who is it that says, I have a tradition, that and my father told me, and his father told him, these are olives. Who? Okay, we'll get back to you. Yes?
Side question. Why is it logical that they would have used an olive as a measurement if an olive has a risk of changing?
That's the other question.
Wait, but if we go with the Chasam Sofer and the Chavos Yair, that I don't have to add up to their measurements, I have to work with what I have today, so then that's fine. I'm using a constant. I don't need to add up to what was 300 years ago. I need to add up to what is today.
Years ago,
they were using their olive, and I have to use my olive.
So
No, I need the right olive, but I can still use a present day olive. The truth is that it's a, okay, I want to get back to that later. Remind me, we have to get back to the question because it's really a little bit off topic. Like, where did this concept of a kezayis come from, and then and your question. But for now, we'll answer it without really answering it. We'll answer it with what will suffice for our discussion, that it's okay because we need a present day. We need a present day maker, a din. That's how we go lalacha till today, where we go with our present day olives. I'm just saying that there are a lot of topics where people want to bring in archaeology when in fact either the archaeology is inconclusive or its halachic ramifications are irrelevant, like the question of a kezayis, etc. So it's true that we do take science into account, and it's true that we would be interested in knowing a lot of things, and through that we could verify certain things, but we have our limitations based on the source of how the halacha evolved. Sometimes the fact that once upon a time the halacha was this way will not affect the way the halacha is now. So that's part one, and we'll pick up with part two in a few minutes.